I don't know how many of you have a fishing license or not, but there was an old fisherman walking on a beach, and he was carrying a few fish in a bucket. And the game warden walked up and said, "I want to see your fishing license." And the old man says, "Well, I don't have a fishing license." And the game warden says, "Well, you know it's illegal to fish without a license, don't you?" And the old man said, "Well, I wasn't fishing, officer. These fish in the bucket here, they're my pets." And the officer goes, "Well, what do you mean, your pets?" And the old man says, "Well, yes, officer, you see, these fish, they like a little exercise. So when the weather's good, I take them out here to the lake and I let them swim around for a little while. And then after a while, I whistle and they come and jump back in the bucket." Well, the officer, he wasn't buying any of this story. So the old man says, "Well, you don't believe me? Just watch." He takes the bucket, throws the fish into the lake. And the warden waits for a minute or two, and he says, "Okay, now whistle and call your fish back into the bucket." And the old man said, "What fish?" Now, he obviously knew the rules, and he knew the law, and was trying to avoid that particular event. I have three major points today, and I'm entitling the message, Three Instructions in Micah 6:8. Three instructions in Micah 6:8. And if we look at Micah 6:8, it's not a complicated verse. It's in what we call the minor prophets, Hosea, Joel, Amos, Jonah. In Micah 6:8, "He has shown you, O man, what is good, and what does the Lord require of you, but to do justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God." Well, to understand the verse and all that it encompasses, we have to see what led up to that verse in the book of Micah. Micah was known as a minor prophet, minor only in the size of the written book, not minor in the importance of it, the prophecy. According to the Abingdon Bible Commentary, Micah was a contemporary of Isaiah the prophet. Micah was from a rural village in the northern kingdom of Israel, and Isaiah was from a bigger city, Jerusalem, in the southern kingdom of Judah. Well, the kings of this period in the northern kingdom were Omri and Ahab, and then there were a whole series of shorter ruling kings named Zechariah for 6 months, Shalom for a month, Menahem for 11 years, Pekahiah for 2 years, Pekah for 8 years, Hoshea for 9. But slowly, step by step, the nation of Israel became vassals, the northern kingdom, of neighboring Assyria. And Assyria became militarily weaker and weaker, and they had to pay tribute or taxes to their enemy, Assyria. And then about 750 B.C., the prophet Amos comes along, and he carried a message that justice was important to God. In Amos 3:10, we read the essence of Amos's message, "For they do not know to do right, says the Lord, who store up violence and robbery in their palaces." The palaces means a place of rule. So the government was not behaving itself. They were using violence and robbery to facilitate their own power. In Amos 4, verses 1 through 13, I won't read it all, but there's a list of reasons why God was unhappy with Israel and that justice was coming because they had abandoned God's law. So Amos's message then was about justice. Then the prophet Hosea pointed out that love is an important requirement by God. In the book of Hosea is a story of patience, how Hosea was repeatedly merciful to his wayward wife. And he preached that God desired the quality of mercy to be displayed, that the spiritual qualities of mercy and understanding were even more important than conducting sacrifices. Well, how much more then did God expect mercy to be administered? In Hosea 6:6, we read, "For I desired mercy," meaning God desired, "and not sacrifice, and the knowledge of God more than burnt offerings." God had a hierarchy, priority, and he wanted people to think like him. Isaiah followed up then. We've had Amos, Hosea, and Isaiah. followed up, noting that God requires holiness. Holiness is a special setting apart by God for a special reason or purpose. In Isaiah 35 and verse 8, in Isaiah 35 and verse 8, "And a highway shall be there, and a way, and it shall be called the way of holiness. The unclean shall not pass over it, but it shall be for those, the wayfaring men, though fools, they shall not err therein." He's saying it's an important important characteristic to respect the holiness that God is offering. Now, Isaiah's prophecy is dual. He spoke of the way of holiness before God and that the people of Judah and Israel should seek holiness, and those who did not be spared from the misery to come. Well, this is a dual prophecy because it also speaks of the future kingdom of God that we heard about in the sermonette. We must seek and follow the way of holiness in order to enter God's kingdom. Well, by this time, and we're around 750 BC, the sins of the southern kingdom of Judah and the northern kingdom of Israel, they were both beset by the same sins, and the prophets were warning them. Then along comes the prophet Micah. And what does he do? He denounces rulers, priests, false prophets, and deplores the money-grubbing exploration of the helpless, the dishonest in business, and a sham religion. And we read this in Micah 3:11. Again, the heads thereof judge for reward, and the priests teach for hire, and the prophets divine for money. Yet they will lean upon the Lord and say, "Is not the Lord among us? No evil can come upon us." So they're saying, well, God's watching out. We can do pretty much whatever we want because we're pretending to be righteous. Well, Micah was pointing out that the rulers took bribes. So did the priests. So did the prophets. And the entire society was not following God's ways. And yet the rulers, the priests, and the prophets all claimed that God was with them, that no evil would befall them because they had God on their side. I might put a little inset to say, they said God, that they had God on their side. It's really a better perspective is we should be on God's side rather than expect God to be on our side. So if we look around in our present society, do we have rulers who gather money to themselves? If you examine politicians who have been in office for a while, they seem to be better off financially when they come out of office than when they went in. What about religious leaders? Well, just as in Micah's day, there are modern religious leaders who soil their hands with money. Have you ever heard of a religious leader taking a paycheck and then living on an expense account while he subverts the very organization by that paycheck and expense check? What about a religious leader who willingly accepts expenses just in order to get himself a better position and then resigns? Of course, we see false prophets on television, and they vigorously announcing the exact date of the end of the world, which they call the rapture. I've listened to those on the radio when traveling. And those false prophets, they reap millions of dollars of income to get people to donate their life savings to support their cause into the false ministry. I had one fellow, he contacted me through the church website, and we talked for a long time on the phone. He had suffered severe financial loss because he believed them, and he donated most of his life's assets into the organization, and they were quite willing to take his money without blinking, without regard to his own well-being, and put him in a bad way. In short, Micah 3:11 applies just as much today as it did to ancient Israel and Judah. Well, carrying out the warning message to Israel and Judah, Micah combines the messages of Amos, the message of justice, the prophet Hosea talked about love or mercy, the prophet Isaiah about holiness or humility, and he put it all in one verse, which we read, "He has shown you, O man, what is good." And what does the Lord require of you in Micah 6:8? "But to do justly, love mercy, and walk humbly with your God." You notice that Micah styled his statement in the form of a question, and then he answered his own question. It's sort of like the TV game show Jeopardy, where the answer is given in the form of a question. Unfortunately, the message from the prophets of Amos, Hosea, Isaiah, and Micah were not closely followed. and the entire northern kingdom of Israel suffered. In 722 BC, the Assyrians besieged Samaria, the capital of the northern kingdom of Israel. The previous king Omri had spent a lot of time and money fortifying the walls of Samaria, and it took Assyria 3 years to breach the walls of Samaria and destroy the city. Now, I don't know if any of you have been to Europe, old medieval Europe, and we'll have the feast near Old City Tallinn this year in Estonia. The walls are very thick, 30 feet thick, 30 feet high, maybe more. And you think, what does it take with primitive weapons to try to get through the city? Now, they had catapults and trebuchets and things like that that were made it difficult. But you just don't walk up, knock down a door. You know, it takes time. And here, in this case, it took 3 years. But imagine the people behind the walls with the army surrounding them. What went through their minds, the horror that they had to live through before the city fell. And it was in 30 years, from 752 BC to 722 BC, the powerful northern kingdom of Israel ceased to exist as an independent nation. Well, now we've examined some of the history of Micah 6:8, to do justly, love mercy, and walk humbly with your God. How then do we follow the admonishment of Micah and the other prophets here and now today? Some of you may have heard of the Oklahoma comedian of years ago, Will Rogers. And he said it well. You may have heard me quote it before, and I'll paraphrase his comment to clean it up for church. Some people learn by reading. Some people learn by observing others. And some people have to touch the electric fence for themselves. Well, people in the prophet Micah's time, they didn't follow God's laws. Whether they learned of God's way in a written form from the scripture, they could have done it by reading, or by personally observing the bad results that happened to others who failed to follow God. Or they didn't personally observe, did fail to understand their own negative experience for themselves. The story then of what happened to ancient Israel and Judah is written down for us to understand. And we can learn by reading and observing what has happened to others. And when we read Amos, as we've mentioned, 4 verses 1 through 13, it's very unsettling as to what's going to happen to those who refuse to follow God. The prophecies were intended for the whole society then, just as they're put in paper for us to read for our entire society today. That way we don't have to touch the electric fence for ourselves. So what do we do here, now, today? If we take a look at Ecclesiastes 7. In Ecclesiastes 7, verse 20. Well, there's not a just man on earth that does good and sins not. In other words, everybody's guilty of failing to fully follow God's law. But here in Ecclesiastes, there isn't a just man. What's a just man? The one that's following God's law, doing what's right. Well, in Micah 6:8, what's the first thing required of us? Do justly. Well, how can we know what doing justly entails? What does it mean to do justly? We're going to answer that question, but first let's look at the characteristics of unjust men. And we'll take a look at then some just men in the Bible and learn from their examples. First of all, characteristics of the unjust man. We can read in Proverbs 29, verse 27. In Proverbs 29 and verse 27, an unjust man is an abomination to the just. In other words, to people who are trying to do the right thing, you have an unjust man, it's terrible for them. They have bad consequences. What's the last half of the verse? He that is upright in the way is an abomination to the wicked. Now, an unjust man, for example, if you're keeping the Sabbath or holy days, what is an unjust man if he's your boss? He'll mess with your work schedule or maybe demean or criticize your work in front of others. Maybe it's your coworker who's unjust, makes your life difficult, perhaps by false reports or needling remarks. Maybe the unjust person is your teacher at school who mocks God. Or maybe the unjust person is another student who teases or makes an effort to frustrate or embarrass you. Perhaps the unjust person is a government bureaucrat who's not in any hurry to accommodate you. Well, you have limited time, whether it's on your lunch break or whenever, and you've got to hurry up and go for other responsibilities, but they're just taking their time, if they even respond at all. What about the unjust neighbor who disrespects your property, or perhaps has late night parties with loud music or noise, or has a nasty pet they think is wonderful, but it threatens you or your children or damages your property, barks at all hours of the day or night, or leaves presents on your lawn? An unjust person could be another driver when you're out on the road, blocking traffic, following too closely as a tailgater, passing at breakneck speed, pulls in front of you and cuts you off, then brakes suddenly to exit the freeway when they could have just paused for a moment and they could have exited safely. Perhaps the unjust person is a mischief maker, a busybody, whether it's a purse snatcher, or a carjacker, maybe it's a graffiti spraying gangster, or a neighborhood bully. And everybody has heard about the kid who beats up another kid and wants to steal his lunch money. So there are unjust people or everyone. The list could go on and on. And if we sat down with a pencil and paper, we could probably come up with many more types of unjust people. And the list is so long, and the lack of justice is so profound, that in Psalm 43, verse 1, the psalmist cries out to God for deliverance from the unjust man. Don't you wish you could be delivered from somebody who's giving you nothing but grief? In Psalm 43, in verse 1, vindicate me, O God, and plead my cause against an ungodly nation. O deliver me from the deceitful and unjust man. So people are crying out. They're hurting. We have had unjust people throughout history. In the 1970s, there was Pol Pot, the Cambodian dictator. He orchestrated the killing of 7 million people in Cambodia when he thought it was a great plan. They had a revolution. He took over the country. They would depopulate the cities and force everybody to go into the rural areas. Well, the first thing he did was kill everybody who had an education because they were a threat to the government. And they forced people from wherever they were at without packing, without changing clothes, no preparation, simply march into the countryside. He was going to turn them into a rural population from the cities. And it didn't matter if they couldn't keep up. They were shot along the way. Terrible circumstance. There's a book that describes the horror of that time called The Killing Fields. But that was Pol Pot. Ironically, years later, his own group of leaders decided to overthrow him and shot him. We have Fidel Castro in 1959, became the dictator of Cuba through a revolution. And he was born in 1926, died in 2016. And through the Cuban Revolution, many people were impoverished, they suffered, they died under his rule. People fled Cuba from 1959, including a medical doctor who fled Cuba with his children, and one of those today is a pastor in UCG and is the senior pastor for the Spanish-speaking work. Mario Segli fled Cuba, 1959. And Augusto Pinochet, a Chilean dictator, he gained power in 1974 through his participation in the assassination of the previous leader, Allende. I happen to have an uncle-in-law who worked for the State Department and was in Chile at the time. Didn't know until after he died he was really CIA. And he was the one that arranged the assassination. Under Pinochet's rule, 30,000 people were tortured, 80,000 in prison, and about 1,200 to 1,300 people, or to 3,200, were killed outright. That's how you squish your opponents. You put them in prison or you kill them, right? Many people simply disappeared under Augusto Pinochet's rule. Eventually, he fled to Spain, fought extradition to Great Britain, finally was sent back to Chile, and kept alive but died at age 91. What was it? Fidel Castro, he was what? 90 years old when he died. Mao Zedong, communist dictator of China, born in 1893, died in 1976. So what would that make him? 83 years old. He killed between 20 and 40 million of his own people from the Chinese Revolution in 1949 until his death in 1976. Then there was Joseph Stalin, the communist dictator of the Soviet Union. He killed between 20 and 30 million of his own people in Russia and neighboring countries. But let's go back hundreds of years. Tamerlane. Tamerlane was the last nomadic conqueror in Central Asia. And he was around in the late 1200s, and he killed upwards of a million people. Now, his preferred style was to capture an area and then chop off heads and pile them in pyramids of 100,000 each. He did that in Delhi, India in 15 days, and it took 100 years for the population to regrow who he had killed. Did the same thing in Baghdad, in Iraq, made his 100,000 pile of heads. He was on his way to China to conquer China, thought a lot of himself, died of pneumonia at age 71 going over the mountains. There were many other unjust men throughout mankind's history. I just list a few. They took other people's lives and property. They tortured, they maimed. They separated families, they besmirched the innocent. And it doesn't seem like these evil characters lived a long time. Let's take a look at Ecclesiastes chapter 7, verse 15. Ecclesiastes 7:15. All these things I've seen in the days of my vanity. There is a just man that perishes in his righteousness, and there's a wicked man that prolongs his life in his wickedness. I want to point out here, in this verse, the opposite of a just man is a wicked man. They say the just man often suffer, and the wicked man lives a long time. Well, as the writer of Ecclesiastes noted, I've often wondered why and how certain evil people manage to live so long and inflict so much abuse on others. But we've learned that the way of man is the way of misery and death. And in God's way, it produces good fruit. But it's Satan's way that produces the pain, the agony, and the death. Now let's take a look at what those who God calls just men. So let's take a look at these examples. And the first one I came across was a fellow by the name of Noah. Now in Genesis 6 in verse 9, we read, these are the generations of Noah. Noah was a just man. Well, isn't that interesting? First we're told there are no just men, but then it says just. So I would suggest that Noah, why was he called a just man? Well, he obeyed God, and he did so despite the obstacles before him. And there were many obstacles, and he persevered in building the ark. Some folks here have been in the church for many years. They've been keeping the faith, doing their best to follow God. And yet none of us can say that we've persevered as much as Noah. It took 100 years to build the ark, a tremendous example of faith to follow God in a wicked and turbulent society. So why was Noah called a just man? He was pursuing being a justice, what God wanted done, to follow God's laws. So justice, or a just man, is not one who's accomplished being just, but he's on his way. He's seeking to be just. Another example in the Bible of a just man is in Matthew 1:19. Matthew 1:19, and it speaks of Joseph, the husband of Mary. Matthew 1:19, then Joseph, Mary's husband, being a just man and not willing to make Mary a public example, was minded to put her away privately. Well, what did Joseph do to deserve to be called a just man? And not willing to make her a public example, he used wisdom and discretion to consider how to deal with what is a perplexing problem. During the period of his betrothal and engagement to Mary, his future bride turns up pregnant. Joseph practiced true respect and love by not desiring to make a public example of his future bride. Notice the very next verse in Matthew 1, verse 20. In Matthew 1, 20, but while he thought on these things, behold, the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a dream, saying, Joseph, the son of David, fear not to take to you Mary, your wife, for that which is conceived of her is of the Holy Spirit. Joseph wasn't a man who was quick to anger. Why do you suppose he was selected to be the husband of Mary? The task before Joseph was great. He had to raise up a son unequaled in the history of mankind. In this case, a just man, a characteristic was he was slow to anger. He was careful and loving. The next person that I see on the list is called a just man, is John the Baptizer. In Mark chapter 6, verse 20. In Mark 6, verse 20. For Herod feared John, knowing that he was a just man and holy, and he observed him. And when he heard him, he did many things and heard him gladly. So King Herod welcomed John the Baptizer in. Now, this is interesting that Herod knew that John was a just man. Well, at the time described in this writing, what Mark wrote, John the Baptizer was already dead. He had been beheaded by King Herod. And King Herod knew that he had done wrong by having John the Baptizer beheaded. And Herod knew that John the Baptizer was a just man. But Herod was genuinely concerned then that John the Baptist had risen from the dead, but it was actually Jesus Christ at that writing who was then preaching and teaching and healing. And Herod, observing Jesus, heard him speak. There must have been a family resemblance, just my speculation, between John the Baptist and his cousin Jesus. And because King Herod had a guilty conscience, he confused the two. In any event, Herod knew that a just man was before him and that a just man was of God who could raise someone up from the dead. Well, if we read on in Matthew 6 and verse 34, in Matthew 6, 34, here's what occurred following the death of John the Baptizer. Mark 6, 34, beg pardon. And Jesus, when he came out, saw many people and was moved with compassion toward them because they were as sheep, not as having a shepherd. And he began to teach them many things. So we read, following the death of John the Baptizer, the people were as sheep without a shepherd. In other words, this particular just man, John, had the heart and the actions of a shepherd to help people that he was sent to serve. There was another man, a non-Israelite, who was called a just man. In Acts 10, 22, we read about Cornelius. Cornelius. In Acts 10, 22, and they said, Cornelius, the centurion, I'm going to stop right there and insert, a centurion was an officer in the Roman army in charge of 100 men. So Cornelius, the centurion, a just man and one that feared God, and of a good report among all of the nation of the Jews, was warned from God by a holy angel to send for you into his house and hear your words. So Cornelius was a believer in what Jesus said, what Jesus preached. He feared God. And look at the respect that he had as an occupying soldier in a company, in a country that he was occupying. Now, the Bible often uses repetition as a form of emphasis, and the same principle will be repeated using different words. In this case, in Acts 10, 22, the term just man is immediately followed by two characteristics that describe a just man. The first mention is one who fears God. And if we read in one who fears God. One, if we read in 2 Samuel 23, verse 3. 2 Samuel 23 and verse 3. The God of Israel said, the rock of Israel spoke to me. He that rules over men must be just, ruling in the fear of God. So there's a relationship. One must fear God, meaning be in awe of God and respect God and what God says. In Job 28, verse 28, Job 28, verse 28. And unto the man he said, behold, the fear of the Lord is wisdom, and to depart from evil is understanding. So we're getting the definition of a just man fears God, seizes a hold of wisdom and understanding. The second thing about Cornelius that was said after being a just man, it said, had a good report among the Jews. Well, this is really quite remarkable. Cornelius was an officer in the hated Roman army, but he had developed a good rapport with the Jews. So the underlying principle here is it's important to have a good rapport among others, even those who would otherwise despise you. The third thing that is in Acts 22 about Cornelius as the just man is he was willing to listen to the words of God. And the last part of Acts 10:22, to hear words of you, meaning of Jesus. How many people are simply not willing? Not interested, not willing, don't have the time, it's all nonsense, why bother and move on? So if we move on then to verse 30, we find the characteristics of this just man Cornelius. Acts 10, verse 30, and Cornelius said, 4 days ago I was fasting until this hour, and at the ninth hour I prayed in my house, and behold, a man stood before me in bright clothing. Well, that verse alone tells us about this just man. What was he doing? He fasted and he prayed. So we have characteristics here of Cornelius and how he qualified to be a just man. He was seeking to do the right thing under God's view. There is another mention of a man, a just man in the Bible, and it's found in Matthew 27, verse 19. This is the final hours of the physical life of Jesus the Christ. He was hauled before Pontius Pilate for a court hearing. Pilate was a prefect, meaning a local ruler of the province of Judea under the Roman emperor. Pilate, the prefect, reported to his boss, the Caesar, Emperor Tiberius. And as such, Pilate had a job that was a political hot potato. He had to keep the peace in his corner of the world, of the Roman Empire, and he had to be able to extract as much tax or tribute as he could out of the local population. So he had to be had to have control, but he also had to not be too burdensome so that they would develop a revolt. In Matthew 27 and verse 19, in Matthew 27, 19, when he, Pontius Pilate, was set down on the judgment seat, his wife sent to him, saying, have nothing to do with that just man, for I've suffered many things this day in a dream because of him. She was speaking of Jesus. So she sends a message to her husband. I know you're going to judge him now, and it's your responsibility, but have nothing to do with him. He's a just man. Whoa, meaning he's following the law. So she understood, Pilate's wife understood, that Jesus the Christ was a just man. Pilate's wife was fearful of what could happen or would happen. So what does Pilate do? He washed his hands in public to demonstrate his attempt to be guiltless in the pending death of Jesus the Christ. Well, we've read Micah 6:8. The first characteristic in Micah 6:8 was to do justly. And we've covered the examples of unjust and just men. And let's take a look in the Bible for other characteristics then that we've mentioned about doing justly. First of all, we must be willing to learn. Willing to learn. In Proverbs 9:9, in Proverbs 9:9, give instruction to a wise man and he will be yet wiser. Teach a just man and he will increase in learning. Person who knows it all can't be taught. We must be willing to learn in order to practice doing justly. I know as a teacher, my wife and I have taught for many years, students have to be in the right frame of mind to be able to learn. We call those having a learning moment where they're able to understand now maybe something has happened, and you use that learning moment. The second characteristic is be honest in our dealings. Be honest in our dealings. In Proverbs 20, verse 7, to be a just man, we must be honest in our dealings. Proverbs 20, verse 7, a just man walks in his integrity. His children are blessed after him. Perhaps you may have seen the Norman Rockwell painting of a small town meat market where the happy butcher, big smile on his face, and he puts his, he's selling meat to a lady, but on the back side of the scale, you can see he's putting his thumb on the scale to make the scale register more weight than what the meat is he's actually selling. So he was actually cheating the person, and so Norman Rockwell was calling attention to that, the painter. We actually got to see that painting in person at Crystal Bridges Museum in Bentonville. And the paintings are like 3 feet wide and 6 feet tall when he paints them. So he had a lot of detail. Then they reduce it, camera reduction down, so that it looks very detailed, really quite remarkable. But we've all been cheated a time or two in life, and we use those experiences to teach our children and grandchildren about how God's way is a better way, where people can deal openly and honestly without the fear of being ripped off. The third characteristic of being a just man, keep trying. Keep trying. In Proverbs 24, verse 16. In Proverbs 24, verse 16, for a just man falls seven times and rises up again, but the wicked shall fall into mischief. How many times in life have we wanted to give up? How many times have we thought the task at hand was hopeless? How many times have we said to ourselves, it's just too difficult? However, we should take comfort that we will not be handed a greater burden than we're able to carry. We read earlier that in Proverbs 29:27, an unjust man is an abomination to the just, and that he that is upright is an abomination to the wicked. If you're doing the right thing, who does that annoy the most? The criminals, the crooks, the unjust people. They're very annoyed if you're doing the right thing, because it impedes them to do the wrong thing. And it's terrible to have to deal with somebody who is unjust. And as we read earlier about the psalmist in Psalm 43:1, about asking for relief, deliver me from the deceitful and unjust man. But if it were not possible to obtain relief from an unjust man, then any pleading to God would be in vain. Wouldn't work. We might as well just throw up our hands, give up, eat worms, and die, right? But it's possible to obtain relief. The psalmist knew that relief was possible, and he sought God's help. We have the advantage of writings of the apostles to make clear a Christian way. In John 14:14, if you ask anything in my name, I will do it. But notice the very next verse in John 14:15, if you love me, keep my commandments. In other words, don't expect to get what you want if you are unwilling to do what God expects of you. So these principles go hand in hand, that we're entitled to ask God to fulfill our needs. But by the same token, God points out that if we love him, we will naturally want to keep his commandments. Now, there's a vivid biblical example of someone who did not throw up her hands and quit when she came upon an unjust man. And this is demonstrated in a parable spoken by Jesus. The parable is often entitled The Importunate Widow, or it's called The Parable of the Unjust Judge, in Luke 18 and verse 1. And it tells us about a woman who was defrauded, so she went to court. And what does it say in verse 2 about the judge? He feared not God nor man. Because I'm in charge here. I'm the boss. I can do whatever I want. We have a lot of attitudes like that in medicine and law enforcement and in the courts. They say, well, I'm in charge here now, so whatever I say is going to be right. And the widow came to him and said, avenge me of my adversary. And verse 4, he would not for a while, but after he said to himself, though I fear not God or regard man, verse 5, Yet because this widow troubles me, I will avenge her, lest by her continual coming she weary me. In other words, don't bother me. Why do you keep coming, bothering me over and over? Makes me look bad, kind of thing. I've seen that in the courtroom, where the judge just throws up his hands and walks away because he's tired of being irritated. Well, so what did the judge do? He threw up his hands and gave her what she wanted. And if we read down to verse 8, and I tell you, he, meaning God, will avenge his people speedily. When the Son of Man comes, shall he find faith on the earth? That's a pretty important characteristic. If you expect God to give you justice, you should be willing to want to do what God wants us to do for our benefit. Now, the widow in this case had very low status, very little power in that society, and in many societies around the world, even today. That's why in Deuteronomy 24, widows were specifically provided for by leaving the corners of the field and the gleanings of the crops and orchards, so the widows might be able to harvest regardless of who owned the land. And we read about that practice in the book of Ruth, where Ruth and Naomi gleaned in the fields. But in this parable in Luke 18, the unjust judge, he, in his own mind, he knew he didn't have to hear the widow's complaint because she had nowhere else to go. He had the power, and she didn't. Well, just as God has provided for the weak and the powerless to overcome injustice, so he provides a way for us to overcome injustice. We can follow the importunate widow and ask repeatedly if we must, and have faith in God and his law. Now, a couple times we referred to Proverbs 29, verse 27. But in that last half of the verse, we read, he that is upright in the way is an abomination to the wicked. Now, you may notice that when you do the right thing, it irritates those people who want to do the wrong thing. And it can start out as a schoolyard, as a youngster, or perhaps in high school. If Johnny comes up and says, hey, a bunch of us are skipping high school today. Bobby has a six-pack. Davey's buying some weed, and we can ride in Freddie's car. His license is suspended, but don't worry, he can still drive the old man's car. Let's go. If you decline to go along, and others may turn and mock you and say, what's the matter? Are you a pansy? Are you going to get caught? You're just a chicken. Bark, 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 you know, and mock you. And that's what happens among schools. I hear a lot about bullying. I've seen it in high schools for many years. What about in the workplace? And pilfering, when one employee pilfers something. Yeah, a little bit won't hurt. It's a big company. They won't miss a little here, a little there, right? Everyone does it. So a little dishonesty. What's wrong? Go ahead, take it, kind of thing. They won't like it if you don't like it. And these are pressures that children and grandchildren and co-workers' families face every day. The peer pressure is strong. Just as we read in Proverbs 29, 27, it's hard to do the right thing in face of intense pressure from those who abhor God's laws. Well, that's about doing justly. In Micah 6, 8, what's the second characteristic? Love mercy. Well, the second point there, about loving mercy, let's focus on mercy. It's often used to demonstrate forgiveness. In Matthew 18, and verse 23, and thereafter, we can read about a parable in Matthew 18, verse 23. The kingdom of heaven is like a certain king which would take account of his servants. And somebody owed him a lot of money. And what happens if we read on this particular servant of the king forgave a substantial sum. But if we keep reading, what did that king's servant do? He went back to somebody who owed him a little bit of money. And he had no compassion on him. And so he didn't forgive the debt of the person who only owed him a little bit. And so if we really think long and hard about applying the parable, we realize how difficult it is to have mercy on someone who've done wrong to us, but we're called to temper justice with mercy. Now, just as it's reported in Micah 6:8, justice and mercy go hand in hand. We can compel justice, but But do we really want to be judged as harshly as we are often willing to judge others? Now, some people take this admonition to extend mercy to an absurd extreme. Notice the order of the principles in Micah 6:8. Justice comes first, then mercy. We do not read in the Bible that we're to forego justice altogether and simply hand out get-out-of-jail-free cards. Satan would like us to go to that extreme because a libertine example would endorse anything goes in society, which means we don't have to be beholden to any laws because if everything's mercy. Well, if we don't have to be beholden to any laws, well, then there's no justice. But you see, justice is the carrying out of the law. And mercy without justice is lawlessness. So they go hand in hand. Now, mercy is a precious commodity. It's carefully granted. As it says in Micah 6:8, it says we are to love mercy. Love is a pretty strong word. Accordingly, we're to look for ways to extend it in such a manner that it will help the person receiving mercy. Not just that mercy will foster more bad behavior. Is it merciful to let someone off the hook in the name of mercy? Do we want a serial killer to go free again? Is that merciful to the future victims? And of course not. And of course, sometimes it's easier to grant mercy, and other times it's not an easy choice. I've been an employer for many years before becoming a school teacher, big company and small companies, and I've had to terminate employees. And it's never easy to terminate an employee because I've read Micah 6:8, do justly, love mercy. I don't want somebody to terminate me. That would, you know, and that's happened to me when I first came into the church. Bingo. No Sabbath work, you're fired. So there were times when somebody who is, you come across somebody who is incompetent, insubordinate, maybe a thief, a bumbler, or had one gal came to work in a miniskirt, which was annoying the customers and the staff alike, and then one that was really difficult had body odor that he never recognized. How do you deal with that? I mean, there was just a lot of reasons that people simply need to go work somewhere else. And so I always invited them to go work somebody else, but I didn't fire them on a Friday afternoon at the end of the day because then they would just grovel and get mad all weekend. So it was always earlier in the week, and it was always early in the afternoon, and I would say, you deserve to work for somebody and a job that you really enjoy, that you want to do, and that you feel good about, you can be helpful at, and I want you to be happy. So you should work somewhere where you can, and I'm going to give you 2 weeks to find a job that you can really, really enjoy. So today, I want you to go down to the state employment office, file for unemployment. I'm not going to contest it. And here's a check for 2 weeks' pay for the next 2 weeks. Go out and find a job that you like and that you can work hard for. Now, that was cost me money, but it's a lot easier than to get sued by somebody who was grumpy. And it's interesting, over the years, I've had people come back over the years and said, thank you for changing my life. I found a job I really liked, working for somebody I really want to, or I recognized a problem I didn't know I earlier had. And ironically, of those people, they all came back and said thank you. Unlike the example of the of the lepers, only one out of 10 came back. They all came back. One fellow was he had been with me for years. His performance went down. The decision making's got bad. And I finally had talk after talk. Performance didn't get any better. And I finally said, Ron, I'm going to have to let you go. And the next year he came back and he said, I want to thank you. You didn't know it, he said, but I had become an alcoholic. I never drank on the job. But he said, I drank like a fish when I wasn't on the job. And it affected all of my life. He said, with your prompting, I went through a program and shook off the addiction, the practicing of the addiction, he said, got a job in the industry. Several years later, I hired him back. He came to work for me, became my right-hand man and a top employee, because mercy is a precious commodity. It has to be carefully applied. The third characteristic in Micah 6:8, the third point is to walk humbly with your God. Well, we read earlier that Isaiah stressed the importance of holiness, that setting apart by God for a special purpose. And in order for us to be one, at one with God, to be truly holy, we have to be humble. We can go to Luke 18 and verse 9. And this is the parable about two men who went up into the temple to pray. One's a Pharisee, the other a publican. A publican is a tax collector. As you can imagine, how many people want to develop a close relationship to a hostile IRS agent? And so that's what we have. And a Pharisee was a do-gooder, better than thou. And so what does the Pharisee say in Luke 18, verse 11? I want to thank God that I'm not as other men. And they're all extortioners, unjust, adulterers, even as this here publican tax collector. And then he goes out and he congratulates himself for what he does. I fast twice in the week, give tithes of all I possess. But then the tax collector says in verse 13, he wouldn't even lift his eyes up, but he smote himself and said, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. Now this is a parable. And Jesus said, which one was justified in their conduct? And of course, one exalted himself and the other abased himself, humbled himself before God. So if someone loves justice and they love mercy and then they brag about it, make a big show, didn't they really miss the point? I mean, by calling attention how often we fast or pray, or perhaps how righteous we are, is that really a loving and respectful thing to do? In 1 Corinthians 13:1 gives us that example. Though I speak, 1 Corinthians 13:1, though I speak with the tongues of men and angels and have not charity, meaning love, I am become as a sounding brass or tinkling cymbal, making noise. If we toot our own horn, how righteous or humble we are, then the verse says we're just making noise. So people somehow misconstrue God's instructions in all three areas of instruction of Micah 6:8. What does the Lord require of us but to do justly, love mercy, and walk humbly with our God? Notice the verse says what is required of us. It doesn't say what is suggested for us. It doesn't say recommended or ask us to consider. It's an imperative. These three points are expected of us. But fortunately, like all of God's instructions, these things are there for our lasting benefit. Sometimes we just read over Bible verses and we're quick to apply the verses to someone else. When God says to do justly, we project that command on other people because we expect them to do justly, and especially to us. And the command actually says for us to do justly to others. That doesn't mean that other people are going to reciprocate and do justly to us. In fact, our life experience, I'm pretty sure everybody here will have known that doing justly is the exception instead of the rule. And that we as humans often expect justice of others with not always necessarily doing it ourselves. People also expect others to show mercy, show mercy on them, but they're a little less willing to show mercy on the other guy. God expects us to do justly, but act in a balanced way, balance it with mercy, knowing that there are exceptions. And if we manage to do justly and to love mercy, then the challenge for all of us is to learn to walk humbly with our God. It was 13 years ago, a dear old friend died. Some of you may have known Leonard Scriber. He was my minister over 40 years ago. I remember the first year he was at the Feast of Tabernacles coordinator in Eugene, Oregon. And I was working on the 24-hour communications team. So I was at the early planning meetings for the feast. Mr. Scriber made it clear to all department heads and volunteers, their job was to make their job look easy. And he said we were all to be relaxed and all of the and approach every situation in a calm and deliberate manner. And that calm and easygoing example would ripple across the feast by radiating a good sense of comfort. He demonstrated the importance of being humble servants. If someone made a mistake, he allowed them to correct it without making a big deal about it in public. I will long remember Leonard Scriber as a man who practiced Micah 6:8. Well, today we looked at the 8th century BC history around the time of prophets Isaiah, Hosea, Amos, and Micah. We saw how Micah focused together the principles of Isaiah, Amos, and Hosea. We looked at examples of unjust people throughout history. We've had a brief overview of some of those unjust men, and we reviewed the lives in the Bible of who was being a just man and why they were considered just. We also looked at Scripture to give a more complete understanding of what it takes to become a just man. And we explored the biblical teaching of mercy, and we saw that justice tempered with mercy must be accompanied by humility in our walk with God. So what does the Lord require of you? Do justly, love mercy, and walk humbly with your God. Mr. Watt.